This Week in Palestine offers news from a Palestinian perspective. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC Boston College or its Board of Trustees.
Walk with me, my son, up over the hill. Let me show you the land where our memories still live. See those broken stones where the old house once stood. That was our home, where we laughed and we loved. That big farm right there, with the olives so green, they stole it from us, you know what that means. We harvested life from the roots of these trees. Now they're strangers' hands taking all that we need. Look, son, that was our village. Now it's dust and it's pain. They came from the west with their guns and their chains. But remember these fields. Remember. One day we'll return, I swear it again. We gathered here, family, under the moon. Stories and songs now all gone too soon. They burned every door, they tore every wall. But they'll never take what we carry in our souls. Teach your children the truth, let it live in their veins. This land is ours, no matter the chains. Through fire and time, through exile and years, our roots run too deep to be washed by their tears. Look, son, that was our village. Now it's dust and it's pain. They came from the west with their guns and their chains. But remember these fields. Remember our name. One day we'll return, I swear it again. So walk with me, son, don't turn away. Hold this land in your heart every day. For as long as we breathe, the promise remains. We will return to our home again. Look, son, I'm still holding the key.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are. This is your host, Bethany Marks. Welcome back to another episode of This Week in Palestine. Today, we turn our focus once again to Gaza and the West Bank because the world continues to watch, and the suffering continues. Today is Sunday, May 25, 2025. Before we begin today's program, I want to share an important announcement. This Thursday, May 29, from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m., there will be a Stand Up for Gaza gathering at the main Harvard Red Line entrance. Bring signs, banners, and your voice. This demonstration stands against genocide because opposing genocide is not anti-Semitism. It is a call for justice. Together, we will speak out against deliberate starvation used as a weapon of war. Sign the international call to confront famine in Gaza. Support students defending Palestinian rights. Demand a ceasefire to end the slaughter and release prisoners. Push for Harvard to divest from companies profiting off weapons for genocide. Condemn the complete destruction of every Gaza university. Now is the time to raise our voices, stand together, and demand action. Justice cannot wait. Please join the group. We need your voice. You're listening to This Week in Palestine. As we all know, the debate in the UK Parliament has sparked a fire. Some members calling for an end to this war, while others still defend Israel's actions in Gaza and the West Bank. The argument rages on, but the fact remains, the genocide is still happening. Last week, we discussed the MPs who, after more than 20 months of silence, finally spoke up. A shift, however late, is still a movement. Do we criticize them for the delay, or do we acknowledge their effort? That is the question. It's too late for gratitude. The truth is emerging, and silence once a shield has become an undeniable stain. Where have you been for the last 20 months? The world watched, the world cried, and yet those in power remained silent. Now, as condemnation trickles in, we ask, is this sudden shift in stance genuine, or merely an attempt to salvage reputations? We acknowledge the MP's statement alongside the French and Canadian governments, threatening consequences over genocide and the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. But isn't it 20 months overdue? David Lambie, in your thunderous speech before the British Parliament, you decried Israel's actions in Gaza. But where was this outrage when Defense Minister Yoav Gallant openly vowed to protect British citizens from prosecution if they served in the Israeli army? You heard it, loud and clear. And yet, you did nothing. The British government continues to supply Israel with weapons, enabling its destruction while conducting surveillance flights over Gaza from its military base in Cyprus. And still, you claim moral high ground? You have stood firmly behind Israel for years, ignoring atrocities. Now, as the walls of deception crumble, suddenly you see injustice? Suddenly, you speak? And the media, desperate to rewrite history, shifts its tone. Look at Piers Morgan, once unwilling to hear criticism of Israel, now discussing genocide. Why now? Because the evidence is undeniable. Because the people refuse to be silenced. But do not mistake this moment for absolution. We will not be deceived by governments scrambling to cover their tracks, nor by the media that once enabled silence. We will not be controlled. The pressure will rise, the voices will grow louder, and the truth will be laid bare for all to see. Peaceful, relentless resistance. That is our path forward. We will expose every lie, every cover-up, every act of complicity. We will ensure history remembers the corruption and the betrayal. We are the people, and we hold the power. Meanwhile, diplomatic efforts from the United States, Qatar, and Egypt aim for a ceasefire, but Netanyahu's government has made it clear they are not stopping. The footage, the documentation, the images of devastation, none of it has halted the bombs. The world watches, horrified, but the machine continues. Even Pope Leo XIV, in his first Sunday blessing as pontiff, has urged for an immediate ceasefire and called for humanitarian aid. His words echo those of Pope Francis, who repeatedly championed peace in the region. But as powerful as those voices may be, as strong as global leaders' statements should be, they remain unanswered. And here's the uncomfortable truth. If roles were reversed, if Palestinians had inflicted this level of devastation, the world would have reacted differently. There is no question about that. Just a reminder, Israel is not indigenous to this land. It is an occupation built by settlers from the US, Russia, and Europe. It is not Palestine occupying Israel, but Israel occupying Palestine. That distinction matters. The movement has begun. The UK Parliament has started to shift, but it cannot end there. The voices must grow louder. The pressure must increase. We need more than statements, we need change. Another reminder, because the world needs to hear it again, this war, this genocide, is not the way to bring the hostages to their families. Whatever Netanyahu claims, military force has never been the solution. Look at the record, almost all the hostages were freed through negotiations, not bombs, not destruction. And in the pursuit of war, a generation has been orphaned, scarred, left to carry the weight of devastation. Opposing the expansion of genocide is not weakness, it is strength. Strength is standing up against injustice, refusing to turn away while thousands of children are lost. Strength is speaking, demanding more from our governments, calling for action instead of silence. Netanyahu's future is tied to the continuation of this war. This genocide shows no signs of stopping, and every excuse he presents serves only one purpose: his own survival. If the war were to end, he would face a reckoning dragged from court to court, held accountable for corruption, and the destruction left in his wake. The longer the conflict rages, the more he evades that fate. The toll on Gaza is staggering, the devastation irreversible. This is not about hostages, not about security, but about power, about prolonging chaos for political preservation. Despite international efforts for a ceasefire, his government refuses. The suffering continues, the destruction compounds, and the world watches, horrified. Opposing the expansion of genocide is not weakness, it is strength. To stand against it is to demand justice for the generations orphaned and traumatized by this war. Voices around the world are rising. Some governments are finally beginning to act, as seen in the UK, but more must follow. Silence is complicity. The world cannot afford to hesitate any longer. How much more will be lost before the world forces an end to this horror? Scream. Speak. Refuse to let silence bury the truth. Hold your governments accountable. Shake the foundations of indifference. Let the world hear. Let them know this cannot continue. As suffering persists, our voices must rise. We must amplify those calling for justice, for dignity, for life itself. Silence is not just inaction, it is complicity. And complicity is unforgivable. Now, we are seeing three sides emerge in the global conversation about Israel's actions in Gaza and the West Bank. The first side stands unwaveringly with Israel, supporting every decision without question, even when those decisions lead to genocide. They refuse debate, reject alternative viewpoints, and hold the conviction that Israel has the right to act without restraint. They call themselves Zionists, speaking loudly, yet shutting out dissenting voices. The second side acknowledges the devastation and opposes the continued genocide, yet still defends Israel overall. Their voices rise in protest against the ongoing slaughter, but their actions remain controlled, limited by the influence of Zionist narratives. They express concern, but they hesitate to fully confront the reality. The third side consists of those who sought the truth, those who searched for facts, studied history, and refused to accept blind allegiance. They are the students protesting on university campuses, the workers fired for demanding peace, the activists persecuted for standing against injustice. They are the ones who will not let silence bury the suffering, who understand that opposing genocide is not a sign of weakness, but of strength. This incident is another stark reminder that suppression of truth remains a central strategy in the ongoing occupation. Israeli soldiers firing warning shots at a delegation of diplomats from over 20 countries during their visit to the Jenin refugee camp on May 21, 2025, was not just an act of intimidation, it was a clear message. Voices that dare to witness and speak out will be silenced. Among the delegation were representatives from France, Spain, Italy, China, Japan, Mexico, Ireland, Germany, Canada, and the UK diplomats who had come to observe the humanitarian conditions in Jenin, where thousands of Palestinians struggle under the weight of occupation. But before they could fully document the reality, gunfire erupted, forcing them to take cover. A chilling reminder that no one, not even international officials, is exempt from Israel's tactics. The Israeli military justified its actions by claiming the delegation had strayed from an approved route, but such explanations ring hollow. This was not an accident. It was a calculated move to deter international scrutiny, an effort to keep the suffering of Palestinians hidden from global eyes. In response, international outrage has surged. France and Italy have summoned the Israeli ambassador, calling the shooting unacceptable. Ireland's deputy premier condemned the attack outright, demanding accountability. Germany and Ireland have confirmed their diplomats were involved and are seeking an explanation. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry labeled the act a deliberate attempt at intimidation, and the EU's foreign policy chief has called for those responsible to face consequences. This escalation comes at a time when Israel faces mounting global condemnation for its relentless military offensive in Gaza. More than ever, voices around the world must rise in solidarity. The attempt to silence the truth must be met with an unyielding commitment to expose it. The world is watching and history is recording. Silence is not an option. You are listening to This Week in Palestine. Truth and Justice Radio. I stand in solidarity with everyone dare to say the truth. I stand in unwavering solidarity with Majida Bent El Quds, the 14-year-old girl from Gaza who, just weeks ago, bore the unbearable grief of losing her entire maternal family in a single bomb. She counted their names one by one, her voice trembling yet unbroken as she told the world, "Keep watching. I am the next target." I stand in solidarity with activists Ahmed El-Masri and Samar Mubarak, who disrupted the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio's first Senate hearing, refusing to let silence be the final verdict on oppression. I stand in solidarity with actor Blakely Bartley, who bravely amplifies the voices of Palestine on her TikTok channel, using her platform not for spectacle, but for truth. I stand in solidarity with Mrs. Rachel, a creator of toddlers learning programs, who refused to look away as Palestinian children fell victim to brutality. She spoke when many others remained silent. I stand in solidarity with Logan Rozos, the NYU student denied his diploma for daring to speak the truth about Gaza at his graduation ceremony. His words met not with punishment, but with the resounding cheers of his peers, a testament to courage. I stand in solidarity with Cecilia Culver of George Washington University, who stood tall at her graduation and declared the shame of knowing her tuition dollars helped fund genocide. Thank you, Cecilia, and thank you to those who stood with her, refusing to let power erase truth. I stand in solidarity with Neves Manda, owner of Tivra Santa Chiara, a small restaurant in Naples, Italy, who turned her business into a refuge of resistance, denying service to Zionists in solidarity with Palestinians. Though she was met with attacks, false accusations, and an onslaught of one-star reviews, she did not bow. She stood, resolute, and declared, "This is a free space, a space of defiance against apartheid." I stand in solidarity with every free soul, every courageous heart, every voice raised for Palestine. To all who have spoken, to all who have acted, your words, your resistance, your humanity will not be forgotten. The world hears you. The world sees you. And history will remember. As British MPs begin to publicly condemn Israel's actions and as European nations gradually distance themselves, the reality remains unchanged. Military aid to Israel continues to flow. The bombings persist, and the death toll rises. The world watches in real time, witnessing the devastation unfold, yet the governments fueling this machine of destruction refuse to act decisively. Their words of condemnation ring hollow as long as their support remains steadfast. But silence is not an option. We must look beyond the political maneuvering, beyond the performative statements, and see the unfiltered truth of Gaza. The people of Gaza are enduring relentless attacks, their homes reduced to rubble, their voices drowned out by warfare. The promises of humanitarian aid mean little when access is obstructed, when families search for food amid the ruins, when hospitals struggle to function under the weight of unimaginable loss. Let's turn our attention to those who refuse to ignore the truth. Join Nora Barrows Friedman and the Electronic Intifada as they shed light on the latest developments from Gaza on the suffering, the resilience, and the fight for justice that refuses to be silenced. The mainstream media may attempt to reshape the narrative, but independent voices will not be drowned out. The world will hear them, and the world will act.
Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israeli attacks across Gaza have killed more than 700 Palestinians over the last 7 days, according to the latest figures from the Palestinian Health Ministry, as starvation continues to spread after more than 80 days of Israel's blockade. At least 160 were killed in a 24-hour period on Sunday, May 18th alone, including at least 40 in a massacre targeting displacement tents in Khan Yunus. In Jabalia, Beit Lahia, and Gaza City in northern Gaza, Israeli airstrikes killed more than 200 Palestinians in the 48-hour period between Friday, May 16th, and Saturday, May 17th, according to the Gaza government media office. Quote, this is a series of ongoing massacres accompanied by the complete or partial destruction of more than 1,000 housing units, the redestruction of what was already destroyed, and the forced displacement of more than 300,000 citizens to the already stricken Gaza City, which lacks any infrastructure to accommodate this massive number of forcibly displaced persons, the media office stated. Among the martyrs, 140 remain under the rubble as a result of the Israeli occupation army's deliberate denial of access to the bombed areas in northern Gaza, the office added. The Israeli attacks in northern Gaza, what it is calling Operation Gideon's Chariots, is, quote, transforming the area into an open and systematic killing zone. Israeli drones have also focused on burning hundreds of tents designated for sheltering displaced persons in the Tal al-Zatar area of Jabalia Camp, Beit Lahia, and other areas in the north, amidst suspicious international silence and the active complicity in the ongoing genocide. The siege on North Gaza has accelerated in recent days. Mahmoud Sherbawi, a young man in Jabalia, filmed himself hiding from Israeli quadcopter shooting on Tuesday, May 20th.
I am now in Jabalia camp and I am trapped by Israeli quadcopters. It's shooting us.
The United Nations Humanitarian Office stated that on May 19th, an Israeli airstrike hit a school in Nuseirat in central Gaza, killing 7 people, including 2 teachers who worked for the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees. On Tuesday, the Israeli military issued further displacement orders affecting 26 neighborhoods in northern Gaza, specifically in Beit Lahia, Jabalia, and its refugee camp, the UN said. The affected area spans about 35 square kilometers and represents 10% of the Gaza Strip. Humanitarian partners estimate that as of midday Tuesday, more than 41,000 people were displaced. About 81% of all of Gaza's territory now falls within Israeli militarized zones or has been placed under displacement orders, the UN said on Wednesday. In Khan Yunus, in southern Gaza, the Israeli military issued displacement orders for 90% of the city area. Hind Hurari of Al Jazeera reported on May 19th that, quote, we saw people evacuating under fire, holding whatever they could carry, and the Israeli forces told those Palestinians to evacuate to Al Muwasi in Khan Yunus, which, she adds, has been targeted continuously by Israeli forces. She says, quote, there has been ongoing attacks by artillery shelling, quadcopters, drones, and airstrikes across the Gaza Strip in areas like northern Gaza, Gaza City, Nusayrat, Deir al-Balah, and Khan Yunis. The situation continues to escalate, and Palestinians are left with no choices, no options, no places to go. Everywhere they go, they're still going to be targeted, she reported. That same day, May 19th, Israeli commandos disguised as Palestinian civilians shot and killed a man and detained his wife and child during a raid on a house in Khan Yunis. Al Jazeera reported that Israeli forces drove a civilian vehicle and raided the home as airstrikes pounded the surrounding area, residents said. Mahmoud Safi, a relative of the family, said that Israeli troops carried what appeared to be luggage and blankets on the top of their vehicle. The assassinated man was identified as Ahmed Sarhan, a leader of the armed wing of the Popular Resistance Committees. At least five other people were killed in the raid, in addition to Sarhan, according to medical sources. Donya Abu Sitta, who is a contributor to the Electronic Intifada and has appeared on this live stream, wrote in Drop Site News that, quote, according to witnesses, they killed Sarhan in front of his family and kidnapped his wife and children and shot dead another child in the street on their way out. Donya witnessed the airstrikes covering for the raid on Sarhan and his family. She reports, quote, I saw F-16 fighter jets and Apache helicopters flying very close by. So close, I felt like I could reach out and touch them. It was the first time I ever witnessed a missile fired from a warplane. I saw the massive orange fireball unleashed as the bomb exploded not far away. The buzzing of the drones overhead was deafening, but the sound of people's screams and wails were even louder. Everyone in the street was scattering hysterically, running for their lives. We live on a block with apartment complexes around a central courtyard, and I saw my neighbors standing by the windows trying to comprehend what was happening. Thick black smoke filled the air. Even though we had endured nearly 600 days of this war of extermination, I didn't believe we would survive this day. It was a living nightmare. Donya added that the Israeli military had carpet bombed the area, launching over 40 airstrikes in 40 minutes on some accounts. Hospitals continue to be besieged and forced out of service by Israeli attacks. Late Wednesday night, the Israeli military carried out artillery fire targeting northern Gaza's Al-Auda hospital, while drones also bombed water tanks at the health facility, according to Al Jazeera. Israel attacked the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis yet again this week, targeting their small warehouse of essential supplies. According to the World Health Organization, around 30% of the warehouse was destroyed. The warehouse was built by the WHO and included critical supplies such as prosthetic limbs, IV fluids, and dialysis solutions. Dr. Munir Al-Bursh, Director General of the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza, said that the damage caused by the Israeli airstrike on the warehouse at Nasser Medical Complex, quote, comes at a time when the stock levels of more than 45% of essential medicines had already reached zero, and basic medical supplies or those needed for surgical operations had exceeded 60% in shortages, even before this attack. Nasser Medical Complex was attacked last week, as we reported, as Israeli forces assassinated a journalist in a bombing that destroyed the hospital's burn unit. In addition, the Israeli military bombed the European Gaza Hospital, also in Khan Yunis, last week. Since then, the hospital has been rendered out of service. I spoke with Dr. Majid Jaber, an emergency room physician at the European Gaza Hospital who survived the bombing and said that it was the last medical facility that was able to provide basic care to cancer patients, and now the entire hospital is out of service following a series of Israeli attacks. You can watch that interview with Dr. Jaber on electronicintifada.net or on YouTube. On May 19th, at the Indonesian hospital in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, Israeli forces surrounded and besieged the facility as Israeli airstrikes targeted the power generators and fuel tanks to operate the generators, sparking a massive fire. Hospital workers told the United Nations that there were 55 people in the hospital, including patients and medical staff, with critical shortages of food and water. Staff and patients were forced to flee on foot, trying to maneuver gurneys over massive piles of rubble on the destroyed streets. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said that Israel's targeting of electricity generators was a deliberate effort to destroy the capacity of the hospitals. Quote, the health situation in the northern Gaza Strip is catastrophic after the Indonesian hospital was put out of service, the ministry said, adding that every single hospital in Gaza is suffering from a lack of fuel and spare parts needed for generators. Tom Potokar, a British surgeon working at the Indonesian hospital, recorded this video after the attacks.
Well, it's another day of devastation here in Gaza. The stories coming from the north, absolutely horrific, particularly around the Indonesian hospital, but also in the Al-Muassi area this morning, where 36 people were killed in so-called safe zone. We've been operating all morning so far, all for explosive injuries. One young woman with leg fracture and a shoulder fracture and a large wound on her buttock, who came in yesterday and is not yet aware that everyone in her family was killed in the onslaught. I mean, it's difficult to describe in words what's happening here. The constant sound of bombardment, jets overhead. If Cambodia was the killing fields, then Gaza now is the slaughterhouse.
That was Dr. Tom Potokar. Dr. Ezzedine Shehab, who also worked at the hospital, wrote on May 18th on Twitter or X, quote, I no longer go to the Indonesian hospital. What foolishness it is to speak of hospitals in a place where life is no longer preserved, but merely postponed. Once I believed, oh, how bitterly I believed, that the presence of a doctor among the dying was a sacred thing, a last stand against the void. But here, where the void has taken residence in the very walls, what can sanctity do? The hospital is surrounded now, not by men, not by soldiers even, but by machines. Drones humming above like metallic locusts, devoid of soul or pity. They know neither suffering nor mercy. They are the purest expression of obedience without conscience. They circle the building like vultures circling a carcass not yet dead enough. We still work at the clinic, though I no longer know if it's from duty or habit, or some grotesque need to perform life while surrounded by death. We whisper, we disinfect, we bind wounds that will open again. The scalpel, once a tool of healing, now feels like an accomplice. At home, the walls speak in cracks, the roof sags under the pressure of memory. The air smells like dust and grief. My mother tapes the broken windows each day with the care of a priest dressing a corpse. My father rations rice with the reverence of a man offering communion. But outside, outside, it never stops. The bombing continues with the faithfulness of a priest at prayer. It does not pause. It does not tire. It beats like a heart possessed by something inhuman. And now the streets, no, not streets, corridors of exile. Rows of tents like gravestones made of fabric. Children play in the ashes, unaware that they are survivors of a war not yet finished. The army says, evacuate. To where? They do not say. Only leave, disappear, unbecome. Famine grows near, but even hunger with its gnawing cruelty is familiar. Hunger is intimate. It is ours. What is worse, what is unbearable, is the silence that follows the blast. The silence in which you call a name and no one answers. The silence where meaning once lived. This is not a war. It is annihilation dressed in the costume of procedure. It is a logic without soul, a godless arithmetic of bodies and coordinates. And still, still, some whisper that God watches. I do not know. Sometimes I think he has turned his face away, not out of indifference, but out of shame. But if you are reading this, if your eyes have reached these words like a boat reaching a shore you thought unreachable, then for the love of all things holy and damned, do not look away. To look away is to become part of it. To forget is to bury us before we are dead. To remain silent is to drive the final nail. Those are excerpts of a tweet by Dr. Izzedine Shehab, written on May 18th. Israel announced earlier this week that it was allowing several trucks of humanitarian aid into Gaza after 80 days of complete closure and an engineered humanitarian disaster. However, the Gaza government media office and the United Nations and its partners said Wednesday morning that no trucks had entered since only a handful came in over the weekend. Late Wednesday evening, the media office said that finally trucks had entered carrying various types of aid, but the total number was fewer than 90. Quote, these aid trucks were allocated to a number of international and civil society organizations as part of efforts to distribute them to the Palestinian people to meet some of their urgent humanitarian needs, the media office stated. The 87 trucks that entered Wednesday evening are just a drop in the bucket compared with the staggering need in Gaza. Some 44,000 aid trucks should have entered since March 2nd, when Israel closed the crossings in flagrant violation of all international humanitarian laws. Gaza requires around 500 aid trucks and 50 fuel trucks daily to meet the bare minimum humanitarian needs of its population, the media office stated. The United Nations Humanitarian Office noted that the Israeli authorities are requiring the UN to offload supplies on the Palestinian side of Kerem Abu Salem or Kerem Shalom crossing and reload them separately once they secure UN teams' access from inside. Only then is the UN able to bring any supplies closer to where people in need are sheltering. On May 20th, the Gaza Media Office stated that 326 deaths had been recorded due to malnutrition, food and medicine shortages, and more than 300 miscarriages among pregnant women were reported over the last 80 days. The humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip has reached catastrophic levels in every sense of the word, the office stated. Euromed Human Rights Monitor said on May 21st that it had documented the deaths of 26 Palestinians, including 9 children, in just a 24-hour period. Quote, these deaths are the result of a deliberate Israeli policy that weaponizes hunger and denial of treatment to kill Palestinian civilians. The Titan blockade, in place since March 2nd, disproportionately targets the most vulnerable and turns the man-made humanitarian catastrophe into a central tool of extermination. Meanwhile, Israeli lawmakers have been boasting that they are enjoying the destruction of Gaza and are calling for its entire ethnic cleansing, while the so-called international community not just watches, but continues to arm and abet these genocidal war crimes and crimes against humanity. Bezalel Smotrich, the Israeli finance minister, said that Israeli forces intend to, quote, level all of Gaza, just as they leveled Rafah. In remarks to Israeli army radio this week, Smotrich said that, quote, the army's operation aims to occupy and cleanse areas in Gaza, and every house we destroy is considered a tunnel in our view. On May 19th, Smotrich gave a speech boasting of Israel's strategy of mass destruction in Gaza, saying the token amount of humanitarian aid is only being allowed in, quote, so the world does not stop us and accuse us of war crimes. The goal, he insisted, is to conquer, clear, and stay until Gaza is dismantled beyond recognition. Jeremy Scahill of Dropsite News analyzed the Israeli government's positions on the humanitarian aid ruse in recent days. Scahill writes, quote, Benjamin Netanyahu has made it clear. His decision to allow a minuscule amount of aid to enter Gaza is a tactical one aimed at quieting international condemnation of Israel's forced starvation of Gaza and to clear the path of a final solution imposed on the Palestinians of Gaza. "We're going to take control of all of the Gaza Strip," Netanyahu vowed Monday in a video released by his office announcing that Israel would begin delivering minimal humanitarian aid, food and medicine only. Netanyahu claimed that international pressure, including from pro-Israel Republican U.S. senators and the White House, required the appearance of humanitarian intervention. Quote, "Our best friends in the world, senators I know as strong supporters of Israel, have warned that they cannot support us if images of mass starvation emerge," he said. "They come to me and say, we'll give you all the help you need to win the war, but we can't be receiving pictures of famine," Netanyahu added. "To continue the war of annihilation," he asserted, "we need to do it in a way that they won't stop us." In a television interview on May 20th, Moshe Feiglin, a high-ranking politician and a former member of the Israeli parliament, also openly expressed genocidal intent. He told Israeli media that, quote, "Every child, every baby in Gaza is an enemy. The enemy is not Hamas. We need to conquer Gaza and colonize it and not leave a single Gazan child there. There is no other victory," he said. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight excerpts of Gaza's Meshahar Generation by Nawar Nabil Diab, writing from Gaza. Nawar writes, quote, "In this war, when I am bored, I go to sleep. But then I wake up around dawn to a bombardment and I am no longer bored. The explosions are so close that I go deaf for a few minutes, only able to hear a buzz in my ear that spreads all the way to my brain. In these moments after a bombardment, I pass through three stages. The first is the silent and frightened stare. I am stunned. I stand up only to sit down again because my legs can no longer carry the weight of my body. I try to process what is happening, but the conscious mind is protective and doesn't want me to pry further. The next stage brings out another coping mechanism, making light of the situation with humor. What a surprise that bombardment was. If my little sister is in the room, we'll say that the explosion was a balloon popping or a car tire. Other times we pretend that the bombardment is no big deal at all. The last is forgetting. I pretend it didn't happen and I go on unfazed. Most days I live in a state of meshahar. Meshahar is a word in Palestinian dialect specific to Gaza that means miserable or terribly unlucky. It's the feeling that bad luck is chasing you all the time. My mom keeps saying that we're a Meshahar generation. We were born when life was collapsing. It describes Palestinians perfectly because war and agony never fail to leave us alone. Israel broke the ceasefire in mid-March, and the war was back, though it was never really over. Over 100 people were killed by Israeli attacks during the ceasefire, and the drones never went away. But with the breaking of the ceasefire came the torturous sirens, the ground shaking, a return to Meshahar. The list of martyrs grew to more than 1,900 in just over a month. It was happening all over again. Israel issued evacuation orders for the Al-Mukhabarat area in Gaza City, where I live with my mother and younger brother. We left for Al-Nasser, another area of Gaza City where my uncle lives. I noticed barely any difference between the two areas. There was Meshahar all around. In our area, you saw stacked bags and blankets, people carrying their lives in sacks and looking hopeless. In Al-Nasser, people were not evacuating, but they also looked hopeless, shopping the empty markets. Sometimes I think that the only beauty that is left in Gaza City is the kind that you create in your own head, through your own observations. It is a way to make yourself feel slightly better. I take photos with my phone, a Samsung, and it has helped me see the beauty in Gaza, which, if you train yourself to see it and to look closely, has no limit. Yet now the beauty I find is a different kind, an aching kind. It hides in people's misery, which breaks my heart. It is the sensation of al-faja, tragedy, the unbearable combination of grief and agony. Those are excerpts from Gaza's Mishahar Generation by Nawar Nabil Diab, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine. Zakaria Sarsak, a 13-year-old boy who has worked as a regular volunteer at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, helping paramedics transfer patients and fill IVs, was treated to a sort of a spa day and a new outfit by friends in Gaza this week. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza.
This is a story of resistance, of breaking free from the expectations imposed by power. A Jewish American settler, once destined to become a soldier trained to load bombs into fighter jets to bomb Gaza, chose a different path, one of conscience, solidarity, and truth. He rejected the glorification of destruction, the narrative that demanded loyalty to oppression, and instead became a voice for Palestinian justice. In a world where silence enables genocide, his choice stands as a powerful act of defiance. What led him to this transformation? What truths did he uncover that made turning away from war the only option? Let's listen to his interview with Katie Halper, where he reveals the journey, the reckoning, and the courage it takes to resist from within.
You just have like a fascinating journey, story. I mean, you were born in the United States, then you wound up in the West Bank. Now you're back in the States. Your politics have changed. You've spent time in jail. Can you tell us how you evolved politically and personally?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people who are in, I would say, more traditional Jewish environments in the United States get this story, this sort of like AIPAC-approved story about what Israel is and what that means for Jews. When my family moved to the West Bank, a lot of the pieces of that the existence of Palestinians was this sort of like problem that Jews wish in their peaceful and loving ways that they could come to an agreement, but the Palestinians don't want that, they only want violence. That these are pieces that in the rhetoric of the settlement started to fall away. And like, as I as a child was repeating them, other settlers were telling me like, no, you don't need to say that here. Like, much more extreme language is used. My settlement is, as a settlement goes, one of the more moderate ones. And still, like, over half of the people here in the past election voted for the Ben-Gvir and Smotrich slate. So getting those people into power. And that, like, was something that, like, was very, I would say, like, discordant for me. As I learned more about the history of the conflict, I was constantly trying to approach it from, well, while this is incredibly scary for me as a Jew, now Israeli, it's much worse for the Palestinians involved. So I was trying to understand always, what is it that makes it so that this is something that they would want to engage in? Why wouldn't they take any of these outs that the Hezbollah narrative, the official Israeli narrative, was saying that we were allegedly giving them? The more I learned about the actual realities of the conflict, the more I saw that Palestinians are not given any out. Violent resistance is not working and does not work. Nonviolent resistance does not work. Protests do not work. Riots do not work. Nothing works. No matter what they do, they are greeted with violence. As a result, a lot of them say, well, if I'm going to lose anyway, I'm at least going to make you lose as well. And it was a hard thing to recognize. For me, it really crystallized during the March return in Gaza when Trump moved the embassy to Jerusalem, where a nonviolent protest was met in many cases with live ammunition, in many cases with like other tactics that led to the death of Palestinian protesters. With over 100 Palestinians dead, nothing else changed. And the Israeli narrative never recognized the groundbreaking nature of the nonviolent protest, the biggest since the First Intifada. And then I realized I didn't want to serve. I was drafted anyway, mandatory conscription. And after going through basic training and specialized training in the Air Force, I was deployed to a base, the closest Israeli air base to Gaza, and told that as soon as I finished up my training, that I would be involved in the sort of combat support for the Air Force, and specifically that I was going to be on munitions and explosives support for the F-16 fighter jets that are used to bomb Gaza. I was doing my best at that point to be sort of like disruptive and not get to that point where I would be involved. I was deliberately failing my tests to sort of pass into being a full soldier. But after some escalating tensions in 2021, the Sheikh Jarrah protests and the lead up to what would become the 2021 Israel-Gaza war, known there as Operation Guardian of the Walls, a preliminary airstrike was called. And my commander said, all right, well, now is sort of an emergency. It's wartime. We're going to pretend as if you passed the test because you're good to go. Now load the bombs onto the plane so that we can drop them on our Gazan targets. And at that point, I realized that there was nowhere else that I could go, nowhere that I could try and compromise and reconcile in a way where what I was doing would not be in direct conflict with my values. For human life, my values of opposing violence, of understanding that it's not a viable solution for solving any sort of conflict, definitely not one where it is a sort of an ethnic and national insurgency movement for their own freedom. And I conscientiously objected to service in the Israeli military, which started a four-month process of Israeli military prison as I fought to be recognized as a conscientious objector, which would mean that under international law, I would be exempt to serve, except that in Israel, you are guilty until proven innocent of lying about being a conscientious objector. So I had to sit out my time in military prison while making my case. But that was really a moment where I realized that beliefs are not things that one can have just internally. There's nothing that about believing something in your heart that makes you any better of a person or can lead to any change. And that actions and going out there and doing something and standing up for your values, even if it makes you uncomfortable, even if it puts you in a place where things are more difficult, is what actually makes change. And that there are a lot of people who sit at home and love feeling like they know the best about themselves, but they don't go out there and actually advocate for those changes. And at that point, I realized this is something that I have to be doing. And so after I was recognized as a conscientious objector and discharged from military prison and military service, I started doing activism on the Israeli left and fighting for the freedom and Palestinians and justice for the occupation and apartheid. And then at Columbia, I continued that work. After October 7th, I found a juice for ceasefire and continued to fight for a vision that I and Mohsen share in common, which is a free and equal land for all Israelis and Palestinians. That's something that is, I think, is very simple and has somehow made people like me and Mohsen have a lot of people who wish a lot of ill upon us. There are people who want to stop equal rights from happening. That's always happened. People who oppose civil rights in the United States, and it's always been the case. And then a lot of other people who are inspired through fear, primarily, to follow those who hate. And part of how I think we will have success as a movement is the ability to both stand our ground and be strong in saying, absolutely, there is no way that I am compromising on my values of justice, of peace, of security, and of freedom. And at the same time, there is nothing for you to be afraid of, that this is a future that is not just good for Palestinians, but good for Israelis as well, that oppression and apartheid are sicknesses that affect far more so the oppressed, but also harm the oppressor. And that a liberated future, whether it was in the American South, in South Africa, or in Israel-Palestine, is a future that is better for everyone.
You are listening to This Week in Palestine. I want to take a moment to answer some of the questions sent to me via email. Karen Saba, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, you asked why I dedicated an entire episode to the British Parliament when there are so many voices in the U.S. that also deserve attention. First, thank you for your thoughtful question. The reason for that focus was simple. I believe the spark of governmental accountability began in the UK, and I wanted to highlight how that momentum could spread to the US. Our officials may soon find themselves scrambling to protect their own interests, and it's crucial to track how these shifts unfold. Another email came from Ahmad Radwan, who asked why I didn't introduce myself as a guest host. I appreciate your question. The truth is, I didn't feel like a guest. I felt like part of a team committed to seeking justice and raising awareness about Palestine. And when my friend Mohammed Al-Ghul, or Mo, as we all call him, asked me to stay on, I accepted without hesitation. I always encourage you, dear listeners, to engage with us. Send your thoughts, questions, and feedback to twippodcasts@gmail.com. Some of you will hear back via email, and others might get a response on air. Your voices matter, and together we'll keep this conversation going. Before we wrap up today's program, a quick reminder to join the Stand Up for Gaza this Thursday, May 29, from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Join the Stand Up for Gaza gathering at the Harvard Red Lion entrance. Bring your signs, your banners, and most importantly, your voice. Together, we will demand action and end to deliberate starvation, support for students defending Palestinian rights, a ceasefire, divestment from weapons profiteers, and accountability for the destruction of Gaza's universities. The time for silence is over. Join us. Raise your voice. Justice cannot wait. That's all for today. Stay informed, stay engaged, and never stop seeking the truth. Until next time, this is your host, Bethany Marks, and you've been listening to This Week in Palestine. If you have questions or want to support our work, please reach out at twippodcasts@gmail.com. Your voice and involvement matter. A heartfelt thank you to our incredible team, working tirelessly behind the scenes to make this show possible. Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Lesh Tran, Tahani Abu Moso, Dr. Rana Awad, Juliet Salome, Olivier, Professor N. Lucas, and Mohammed Al-Ghul. Your dedication keeps this platform strong. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, broadcasting from WZBC Student Radio at Boston College, a space committed to amplifying voices that challenge injustice. We are grateful for your time, for your support, and for standing with us in the ongoing fight for Palestinian liberation. Until next week, stay strong, stay aware, and keep raising your voice.
Walk with me, my son, up over the hill. Let me show you the land where our memories still live. See those broken stones where the old house once stood. That was our home, where we laughed and we loved. That big farm right there, with the olives so green, they stole it from us. Know what that means. We harvested life from the roots of these trees. Now they're strangers' hands, taking all that we need. Look, sun, that was our village. Now it's dust and it's pain.